The Guardian.
Have you always wanted to write a novel, a history, a short story, your epitaph? Want to know how successful authors do it? It's all in a new Guardian book. I'll tell you more at the end of this podcast.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
How do you write a biography? Is there somebody that's really compelling you, that interests you enough that you want to actually take the time to write their story?
I wanted to write about William Harvey because I wanted to look at his theory, which is often treated as an abstract theory in history of science books, in the context of his life and times, the intellectual horizon in which Harvey lived.
Hey, here comes someone now. One small step for man.
There are thousands of great biographies waiting to be discovered this Christmas.
The incredible story from the beginning.
I still meet people on the street now that say, "Have you recovered from that?"
In return for your help, I offer something priceless.
The treasure of Monte Cristo.
I decided to hunt down the story of the real Alex Dumas, the father of the novelist, because when I was a boy, I was so obsessed with the novels of Alexandre Dumas, The Three Musketeers and The Count of Monte Cristo, that I actually hunted down the novelist's memoirs. And the thing that amazed me about the memoirs was that the first whole 200 pages of the book, he doesn't mention himself at all. He just talks about this incredible man who was his father.
The Count of Monte Cristo.
Count on revenge.
What is the purpose of biography these days when we have so much instant charting of people's lives in journalism, on the web, in books, and in whole rainforests of doctoral theses? And there are, believe me, a huge number still being published, ranging from celebrity memoirs of people who are still alive to academic accounts of those long dead. We touched on the celebrity end of the market a couple of weeks back when we remarked on how many old rockers there were in the annual race for top spot in the lucrative Christmas charts. This week, we'll be looking at two very different forms of the genre. We begin by talking to the authors of two historical biographies. Tom Rees is the author of The Black Count, The Real Count of Monte Cristo. Thomas Wright's subject is the 17th century physician William Harvey. His book, Circulation, William Harvey's Revolutionary Idea, has just been shortlisted for the Wellcome Trust Book Prize set up to celebrate medicine in literature. Welcome to both of you. I said these were very different books, so I'd like to start by asking each of you to explain the subject of your books. Will you do the honours to begin with, Thomas, please?
William Harvey formulated the theory of the circulation of the blood at the beginning of the 17th century, and this overturned the orthodoxy of 1500 years established by Galen in Roman times and directly inspired the idea of the heart as a pump, which was developed by Descartes and used as the basis of his theory of the mechanical body.
You make a very bold statement at the start of this, which you said that the impact of his circulation theory on what we now call the history of science and on general culture was arguably as great as Darwin's theory of evolution and Newton's theory of gravity, my goodness.
I think in the context of anatomy and physiology, it was as momentous as Darwin's and Newton's in their respective fields. The influence on culture at large was enormous in the 17th century. It influenced economists, poets, it influenced politicians. So there was this wide appeal that, of course, no longer exists, perhaps because that has been absorbed into the wider culture.
So just tell us about what the thinking was like. What was the intellectual ambiance into which this thinker came? You know, surely people knew that if you cut yourself, blood spurted.
Yes, they knew that. But their idea was that the blood moved very slowly within the body, and that the blood was continually produced and consumed. They had no idea that it was the same blood moving around the body at the same time, and that it moved only in one direction. So it was a very different concept of the movement of the blood.
It wasn't even that far away from Galen's theory that there were two separate circulatory systems. The way you explain it is that one is blue and one is red. Well, you can absolutely see why he would think they were two separate ones, one governed by the liver and the other governed by the heart.
Quite right. Two types of blood and two vascular systems, one focusing on the veins and one focusing on the arteries, the veins carrying the purple blood, as you say, and the arteries, the red blood, we know now that it's because it moves across the lungs and comes into contact with oxygen, and that it changes colour in that way. But Galen at the time had no idea that this could possibly be the same blood, simply moving from one form, being transformed from one form into the next.
Tell us a little bit about what sort of man William Harvey was.
William Harvey was the eldest son of a yeoman family. He bore the burden of his father's ambitions. His father wanted to be a gentleman, and his father wanted his sons to go on in society. He was a social climber, and he fulfilled those ambitions through intellectual achievement, which was probably the only option open to him at that time. So he had the hardness and the ambition of people who go a long way, I think, socially, and also the determination to do so.
He was Charles I's physician, wasn't he?
That's
You don't get much higher than that.
No, to go from the first person in a family to attend university to Charles I's physician, it's an enormous achievement.
Now to another biography that actually could be a work of fiction. It's a story of the man we could call Dumas, not père or fils, but grand-père. He was the father of the Dumas who wrote The Count of Monte Cristo and The Three Musketeers. Tell us why you've exhumed his life story, Tom.
Well, as you say, it's a life story that seems like fiction. In fact, a lot of people seem to read full third or so of my book before sometimes realizing that it's not a novel, and that there are a lot of notes and sources backing up all the incredible things that happened in his life. But it's also very familiar to us as a work of fiction because his son, the son of my subject, General Alex Dumas, went on to become the novelist Alexandre Dumas and to write books like The Count of Monte Cristo and The Three Musketeers, using events and really the exploits of his father's life to kind of make his dad live again in fiction, in these fictional characters. And the reason why I came to the story and came to spend, the last half decade really tracking down and writing the first full biography of this man was, I think, because as a boy, I was so transfixed by the novels. I, in fact, loved them so much that I once hunted down the memoirs of the novelist. And the incredible thing about Dumas' memoirs is that he spends fully the first 200 pages of it without mentioning himself and just talking about this incredible man who was his father.
And yet his father died when he was 4 years old, so he can't have actually remembered very much.
Exactly. That's even more, adds a layer of intrigue to the whole thing. But see, when I first read it, I thought, could he be making this story up? He's the son of a slave. I mean, he's really like history's kind of ultimate underdog, if you look at it. I mean, he's someone who rises from being the son of a slave to actually being a leader who outranks Napoleon in France and who leads 53,000 French soldiers in the conquest of the Alps. He becomes an expert in glacier fighting. Even this guy who was a slave from the tropics, never saw snow until he was 16 years old. Within 10 years, he's a supreme general leading guys up ice cliffs like the Guns of Navarone. And then he becomes the cavalry commander of the French forces in Egypt and all of this. And then he crosses this fellow general, Napoleon, makes an unfortunate enemy, and he gets thrown in a dungeon and his life unravels. But of course, if you know The Count of Monte Cristo, that is the beginning of that book. So, there's so much interplay between fiction and biography here. It's a very exciting story for somebody who loves both novels and history. So
one of the things you do is you describe some of the work you put into trying to unearth his story, one of which leads to a safe.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't really keep that out of my story because it was just such a perfect Alexandre Dumas moment. Another thing that seemed when I was living it like it was out of an Alexandre Dumas novel. It happened because no one had really ever researched this guy's life, so I didn't know where to go. And so I went to the town where I knew the general Dumas had died in 1806, and this is also the town where his boy Alexander, who became the novelist, was born. And I kind of started digging around the town, and there was this lady in the town who had been collecting papers for years, and I corresponded with her. She had hinted to me that she had maybe a lot on General Dumas there that no one had really looked at. But I dawdled because nobody had looked at this story in 200 years. So, I had a lot of other things that were going on. And it took me a few months. And I show up in January of 2007. I was talking to the deputy mayor of the town. I'm really like, I have to see this woman. This is, it's really important to my whole work. And where is she? And he says, well, basically, we'll all be very difficult because she's just dropped dead. And he said, well, this lady was very security conscious. She put everything of importance in a safe. And she didn't have a family and hadn't told anyone the combination when she died. And no one could find the combination. And so I had this big safe. And it was in a government building in France. So that made getting anything done about it even more.
You had to crack the safe, literally.
Yeah, I had to crack the safe. I mean, it was perfect. I had to crack the safe to get to all the sources for my story.
I said at the beginning that these books are very different, but there are similarities. And one of the similarities is about the terrible things that happened to reputations. It's rather tragic that he was painted out of the Napoleonic victory paintings.
This enormous oil painting of a battle he was in Egypt, Napoleon actually ordered that the central figure, which was Dumas, this unmistakably majestic black soldier, he was also enormously tall and athletic. Napoleon ordered not only that Dumas be painted out of the picture, but that he be replaced with a blonde-haired, blue-eyed cavalry officer.
This comes up with William Harvey as well. He fell foul of being a royalist. A lot of his papers were destroyed as well.
That's right. The Roundheads went in and ransacked his apartments. And so we've lost a lot of material about how he came about this theory. They also took thousands of pounds away from him. But as well as that, his reputation suffered. When he published his theory, people thought he was mad, and nobody wanted to go and see him. No, he couldn't get any patients.
And one of the extraordinary things is that Dumas was still being treated according to the theory of the humours in the 18th century, in defiance of everything that poor old William Harvey had laboured his life away to prove.
In fact, it's extraordinary. Neither did William Harvey give up such practices. He was unable to make the leap between this abstract theory, or what he thought of as abstract, and the daily practice of medicine. He didn't pursue any ideas that were available at the time, transfusion, for example, which makes sense if you think of the blood circulation. So even for him, it became impossible to weave this into his everyday practice. And his idea was announced and accepted ultimately as a philosophical idea rather than as something that could change medicine.
Now, you could see both these books as being about the limits of history. That, you know, progress doesn't really happen, does it? I mean, you have Dumas, a great, amazing moment. You talk about it as the first emancipation. And then
The first civil rights
movement. Movement. And then 20 years later, it all goes backwards. He comes back from Egypt a broken man, and everything's been taken away. All the rights that were established have gone.
Not only is his career taken away from him, but what he represented for black people in the world, really, is just completely suppressed. And in a way, what I found was that this remarkable door had opened at the end of the 18th century into something that was really like a glimpse of the 21st century, a sort of post-racial moment. I mean, I found out the head of the French Senate was black. Finding these things as a biographer makes the whole thing worthwhile for me, finding that there are not only forgotten people in history, but really forgotten momentous events that occurred, and because they didn't quite fit the general narrative, they just get swept aside, and for interesting reasons, we don't know about them.
But so partly it's to do with the short-livedness of revolutions, isn't it? I mean, the scientific revolution didn't really take on, did it, for a very long time?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think William Harvey's legacy was probably to the next generation or two generations down, to the founders of the Royal Society, for example. They certainly took on his idea, but they, at the same time, misinterpreted his practice. They portrayed him as an empiricist, so they wanted to cast him in the mould that they were trying to follow themselves, whereas his idea grew out as much of natural philosophy, general ideas to do with the microcosm and the macrocosm, etc., as it did from his observation and experimentation. So his legacy was really taken up, but at the same time, his work and how he derived at the theory were lost in the process. He was a natural philosopher, and his ideas were based in the ideas of Aristotle, and I think that is forgotten.
To what extent are both these books actually about our world today?
Well, my book is about the possible influence the humanities can have over science. And we're obviously living in a time where those two cultures are very separated, very divided, and there's a lot of antagonism between them. And William Harvey was a man who drew on what we would regard as the humanities in formulating his theory. And I think that's a possible lesson we could learn today.
To me, the fact that you could have a black man rise to a level in white society that really was not seen again until now with people like Barack Obama and Colin Powell in the US, and that he did it in a white society that controlled the most lucrative slave empire in the world at the time. And when I found that his son, the novelist, who is not nearly as recognizably black as he is and who's living 50 years later and is the most celebrated writer in the world, is subject to constant racial attacks.
By Balzac, among other
by
people.
By Balzac and by the really the French literary establishment constantly call, he's referred to in the papers as this sort of cannibal, this African cannibal who's destroying European literature, and he's depicted with a bone in his nose and, you know, as a, somebody eating his white characters alive. To see that society can regress so quickly, finding that history is not a straight line, that's really the most relevant thing to me about looking into the past, to find that really you need to keep going back there to understand it's not foreordained that things will stay the way that we think they are right now.
It hasn't escaped the notice of this podcast that it's being published in Black History Month, which is still deemed to be necessary. The Black Count is out from Harville Secker, and Tom's Wright's Circulation is published by Chatto and Windus. So thank you very much, both of you, for coming in. There's plenty in those two books to convince one that truth is stranger than fiction. But fiction can be pretty strange too, certainly in the hands of a novelist as revolutionary, yes, there's that word again, as David Foster Wallace. Joining me now is Sarah Crown, our book's website editor, who has been reading her way through all 1,000 plus pages of Infinite Jest. Sarah, you've done so because a new biography of him has just been published. There's been a lot of talk recently about the death of Cradle to Grave biography, literary biography, hasn't there? Do you think there's life in the old genre yet?
I think if you asked me that question a couple of years ago, I'd probably have said no. And I think that there's an extent to which the biographies of well-known figures, such as, you know, Dickens as the perennial example, are inevitably, they're just going to be raking over old coals because there aren't any new coals, unless there's a sudden unexpected find in the manner of A.S. Byatt in Possession, you know, a stash of letters that changes your view of everything. But having said that, of course, that doesn't preclude people from offering their own interpretation of the facts. And actually, I think the best literary biographies, the only ones that are really worth anything at all, are those that use the life of their subject to kind of gloss the work and to throw out fresh readings of the work that's gone before. And actually, in fact, the ones in which you get a sense of the author, the person who's written the biography as well. I think probably the idea of a cradle-to-grave literary biography that's just a straight rehearsal of the facts of the life. I think we want more than that now, and I don't think there is any room for that kind of thing anymore.
So let's move on now to Foster Wallace. He is one of those people who's been downed with the title writer's writer, isn't he? And I have a terrible confession to make, which is that I have never, ever even read a word of him. Had well, you before this?
I had read a supposedly fun thing I'll never do again, which is kind of that's your way into David Foster Wallace. You know, there's lots of his journalism floating around. He used to write these kind of very long form pieces of journalism for various New York based organs. So I'm sure that you will have read words of his in the past, but I hadn't read Infinite Jest before. So that was kind of, it was sort of quite exciting actually to have a chance to tackle something that big and that long, because generally speaking, as I think I said on an earlier podcast, you're so busy reading with the publishing programme that you never get a chance to go backwards and fill in the gaps. And so it was a real opportunity for me.
So what is so interesting about this biography, and why does he need a biography so soon after his death?
Well, I think that there's probably a lot of answers to that question. I think the reason why he needs a biography is because people are interested in him. And the reason for the great interest in him is that he really is, you know, as we move away from his death and you can see his work in a rounded way, the recognition that he has shaped the direction of American literature. I think he's one of the great late 20th century voices of American literature, and his importance in the canon is only now, I think, sort of being recognised. He's like, you know, he's Pynchon 30 years on, so that's why people want to read about him. And the great thing about this biography is that what you find out about him is it does reflect and interact with the work, and it does enrich your understanding of the work. And particularly reading Infinite Jest and then reading the biography so closely alongside it, you see that there are incidents of his life that are being reproduced and kind of particular neuroses of his. There's a brilliant riff on what it feels like to be really deeply involved in smoking marijuana, which was something that, you know, I hadn't realised that he had direct experience of, quite a lot of direct experience of. And one of the things that you do find out that I was very interested by when you reach the end of the biography is that D.T. Max, the author, actually never met his subject. And I naturally assumed that he had because they were moving in similar sort of literary circles on the East Coast of America. And so I started off by asking him why he'd chosen to write about him in the first place.
The girl with the curious hair showed a boy with the curious flair. Oh, a meta-magician made the saddest decision. David Foster Wallace, why couldn't you find any solace?
You know, I'd always been a fan of David Wallace's, and I remember after David died that I was, that day, I was watching TV somewhere, and on the crawl, the little wordy thing that goes around the bottom of the TV screen, I saw David Foster Wallace's name, and I thought maybe David had finally won a book award, because David Foster Wallace actually never won a major or a minor book award. And, you know, I went home that evening and found out that he had died by his own hand. I'm a writer at the New Yorker magazine, and my editor sent me an email that night and said, you know, would you like to write a piece about what led David Foster Wallace to suicide? I did that piece, and it was a long piece, 10,000 words long, which is an absolute immensity. And I very much felt like I hadn't done enough. People kept reminding me that, you know, David had all sorts of sides to him, and that perhaps I hadn't really captured all the years that were happy or all the years where his talent was growing. I just didn't want to leave off. I wanted to keep at it. And I also, you know, I'd begun enjoying his books again so much. And I kept thinking to myself, well, if I don't do a book about David, then I have to read something else.
And you say in the acknowledgements at the end of the book that you actually never met David Foster Wallace. And this was a real surprise to me because the picture, well, firstly, because the picture that you paint of him is so vivid, but also because your responses to him often felt to me like those of a sort of slightly exasperated friend. And I wondered whether it felt like a real problem to you not having actually encountered him personally, and whether in the end, after you'd written the book, you felt like you did know him.
Well, I almost met him. I was in a room with him. There was a party thrown for him on the publication of Infinite Jest, his brilliant 1996 novel, really the novel that made his reputation. It was a huge party, and it was thrown in a bar, which is sort of weird because David had not had a drink, you know, at that point in 6 years. And really one of the great themes of Infinite Jest is the power of AA, the power of 12-step programs. But I don't know, maybe his publicist didn't worry about that or just thought, well, maybe he wouldn't drink, but we would. And there he was sort of across this brightly lit floor. He looked so unhappy. You know, he had his bandana, at least in my memory, and his little tiny granny glasses and his lumberjack shirt and his Timberland boots. And he looked a lot more like a guy who should be out there sort of, you know, chopping a swath through the Pacific Northwest than in this club for swells. And, you know, I just didn't go up to him. I just thought he didn't look like a person who wanted to, you know, engage in a conversation. In researching Every Love Story as a Ghost Strike, I came upon a letter that David wrote to Don DeLillo the day after, where he said that that it was the first pub party that he had ever been to, and if God is in his heaven, it will be my last. And one thing I like about that is, you know, one of the tricks about David was he wasn't the most relentlessly honest man in the room, and I don't think it was the first publishing party that he had ever been to, and probably wasn't also the last. I didn't mind. Or to put it even more strongly, I craved not having met David personally. You know, there's something so distorting when you know somebody. Of course, you think you know them, and that's why we say you know somebody. But you know, you don't know them, and you only have an intimate personal connection to them. And I really felt that what I wanted to do as a biographer was different, and that if I had a strong personal take on him as a personality, as opposed to as a writer. You know, I would be in my own way. I mean, just as any individual who had a strong take on him was useful and important to me in my work, but, you know, they weren't the only, it was all going to be assembled through a kaleidoscope of different points of view and different takes. I mean, David was a complicated person, so I didn't miss it at all. I'm sure, I don't know that I wouldn't have done it had I known him.
Certainly the complexity of the man comes out very clearly in your book, and you obviously did screeds of research for it, talking to his friends and his relatives and looking at his correspondence, as you mentioned, and obviously his work. What do you think was the most illuminating detail on him that you came across in the course of your research?
It's a wonderful concept. You know, David himself actually was always looking for that moment. He was in therapy. He's the signature of self, of relentless self-observation in our culture. I mean, he's much more than that. He's also a sort of signature of kind of a certain kind of kindness and openness to others. But that came later in his life. I mean, for much of his life, he kept asking himself, like, what made me so messed up? You know, and his gaze, and he had this fierce, brilliant gaze, you know, fell upon his mother, it fell upon his genetics, it fell upon his growing up in the American Midwest. You know, I mean, he was always looking for the answer. That said, I mean, there's so many things I learned about him that shocks me, both positively and negatively. I don't like the phrase warts and all in describing a biography, because I feel like it makes you think that the warts, you know, could be left out and you'd still have the all. I mean, the warts are in the all. I was thrilled, you know, to see how fast, for instance, David goes from a non-writer when he's in university to a writer capable of writing The Broom of the System, an absolutely brilliant 550-page long novel. I was amazed to find how long he'd worked on The Pale King, the book that would ultimately defeat him. There is no archive of David's letters. I mean, people had to trust me with the correspondence to give it to me, and many did. It was, you know, incredibly rewarding to think of people, especially, for instance, from his 12-step group, who would give me his correspondence, you know, who said, okay, this is supposed to be an anonymous organization, but there's learning and there's caring to be gotten out of this book from this writer. Much of the pleasure, and I hope it comes through in Every Love Story as a Ghost Story, was really the pleasure of meeting David's colleagues, meeting his cohort, meeting his 12-step companions, meeting his ex-lovers, meeting his wife, meeting his family. There are things I learned about David that I sort of wish he hadn't done. But, you know, I got many of those things in my own past. But I don't have this one. I never tried to buy a gun to kill anybody's husband when I was in a relationship with them. And David did make an effort to buy a gun. He was dating the memoirist Mary Carr, or sort of dating her, and she was married. And in a moment that I really, you know, your biography can surprise you. And when I first found this out, I have to admit, I did not believe that this basically, you know, I mean, David was a product of middle-class American academic life. He was not a tough guy. All that sort of Jerry Garcia-ish stuff with the bandana and the long hair. I mean, it was not affect, but it wasn't the only person he knew how to be. But he was so anguished over the non-starting quality of the relationship that he did contact an ex-con who he knew from his halfway house and see if he couldn't buy a gun. Can you imagine how this conversation would be different if David Foster Wallace had murdered Mary Carr's husband?
This is a difficult question to answer and perhaps an unreasonable one to pose, but you've obviously spent a long time in his company and a long time in the company of his work, and his reputation currently is swelling. But I wondered what you thought about his long-term legacy and whether we can expect our children, children's children, to be reading him in 100 years' time.
It would be a shame if Infinite Jest isn't something that people read, because I think it is the novel of the turn of the century. Mm. It's really the book. Mm. It's not just what it's literally about. I mean, it's literally about some kids at a tennis academy and another group of people sort of down the hill who are at a rehab house. And you say, well, that's going to date. But actually, I think he has an extraordinary way of capturing the energies and the sort of dysfunctions of our time, almost really as if he was anticipating the internet age. I also think, you know, David reaches people. One of the reasons David's reputation has, or his not his reputation in a literary sense, but so many people know about David now who don't really know David Foster Wallace's writing. Mm-hmm. And they're pulling off of him a sense of somebody, I think correctly, who did something very few writers are doing. Not only did David try to find a way to live meaningfully in the world for himself, but he really does try to help you to find a way to live meaningfully in the world, you know, to be more aware of the world, to sort of face, I'm making it sound more therapeutic or overtly therapeutic than it is. But, you know, there were a lot of comments after he died that I found very smart and very moving on the internet. And one of them went something like, you know, I feel like the world is a lonelier place without David Foster Wallace. You know, there's this sort of cliche that's going around now of Saint Dave. You know, this is a book which, if it's a book about a saint, you know, focuses on more on his profane years, but but acknowledges a conversion at the end. I feel strongly that David does represent and embodies for us the first person of his generation to whom we can and should look. I didn't want to say for moral enlightenment, because that's a phrase that would, as he would say, would make me go to the bathroom. But whom we can look to for some kind of lowercase w wisdom. And I don't think that's going to change unless, you know, the modern internet culture suddenly dissolves and blows away and we find ourselves back in a world of small towns and locomotives instead of, you know, the internet and all its decentralized energies.
You infinite jester, consider the lobster, the morality tester.
D.T. Max arguing there that Foster Wallace was a font of wisdom, which is why we should all know and read about him. Which other authors, Sarah, would you like to see biographised, literary authors?
Well, I think the one that I'm really excited about is the Angela Carter biography that's coming up from Edmund Gordon, and that is due out, I believe, in 2015, although these things have a habit of slipping backwards, so I'm not kind of putting it on my Christmas present list yet. But she is a figure who is probably the equal of David Foster Wallace, actually, in terms of UK literature in the late 20th century. She hasn't been biographised yet, which is kind of a lack, I think, and I can't wait to read that. I think it'll be really fascinating to see how her life and her work interact.
Well, it'd be very interesting to see what form Edmund Gordon chooses, because she was such a fabulist, wasn't she?
Yeah,
you could.
Yeah.
The way that Thomas Wright described circulation as an imaginative reconstruction, you could see an amazing scope for imaginative reconstruction.
Absolutely.
In Biography of Carter,
yeah.
Couldn't
and
you?
I think that's one of the things, you know, that's what you want. In order for literary biography to evolve and to remain relevant, we need these more inventive approaches. I don't think just a listening of the facts, that's not what people want anymore. You want a reading experience as well as something that's informative. And hopefully with a subject like Carter, that should be pretty straightforward. So no pressure, Edmund.
So I'm going to go back immediately and order my copy of Infinite Jest. Thanks to Sarah, to D.T. Max, Thomas Wright and Tom Rice. From me, Claire Armistead, and our producer, Tim Mabey. Goodbye.
Hi, I'm Simon Hattonstone. I'm a Guardian journalist, and I occasionally write books that are not read by many people. Let me tell you about some of the great advice from those who really know how to do it. Top name authors that you can read in a new Guardian book called Write. It's brilliant. Funny, perverse, bonkers and wise. If it sounds like writing, then I rewrite, says Elmore Leonard. There's Anne Enright for despairing writers. Remember, the first 12 years are the worst. So, don't put off that dream of winning the Booker Prize any longer. Get inspired by our new Guardian book, Write. You can get yours for half price, £6.50. Using promo code PODCAST. To order, visit guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Anytime up to the end of October.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.